it's one of the challenges of being an analyst that people like me love, is the fact that there is all this nuance and difference. And, you know, one of the things that I think is also unique about California is how much decision making is done on the ballot.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we are, of course, proudly sponsored now in season three by the Government Finance Officers Association, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and our new sponsor, DebtBook. I'm Justin Marlowe, here as always with my intrepid co-host, Californian Marylander, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Always glad to be here. I'm excited about our guest. There's a lot of crossover connections that we have. But yeah, it is summer here in Maryland. We're in the middle of this really hot heat wave. That's redundant, as I'm sure you are in Chicago. And I just took a cold shower, not because of the heat, though, but because our water heater broke this morning. So the fun of home ownership continues.
Goodness gracious. Well, I suppose if you're going to have to take a cold shower, now's as seasonally as good a time as any to do it. I suppose that's yes. Look on the bright side. Yep. Yeah, we were happy to pass along that heat wave to you back east. It was here a few days ago and better as a memory, but I'm sure there's more to come. So we are today continuing our conversations about California state and local public finance. We're thrilled to have Jennifer Johnston, who heads up the Muni Research Department at Franklin Templeton Investments, and look forward to a really broad perspective on all things California state and local public finance. But looking at it from a credit analyst perspective, you know, we've been very fortunate to have State Treasurer Fiona Ma, Gabe Pettick, the legislative analyst, and lots of others on past episodes who are able to talk about California public finance writ large. But to get that sort of credit analyst perspective, which pulls together a lot of those different views, not just on the financial policies and budgeting policies, but also things like housing affordability, things like the business environment, all these different factors that affect the way that bond investors look at a state and look at state and local credit quality writ large. Really great perspective to have. So we're glad to be able to have her on to complement a lot of the kinds of things that we've talked about on the pod so far. Liz, what are you looking forward to hearing from Jennifer Johnston?
Yeah, I think it is nice to have her perspective after hearing from the state treasurer and from the legislative analyst's office. It does kind of round out that it's almost going to be like having a third party verification or not of some of the things that we discussed earlier. But then with California too, I mean, things are different now than they were even just a few weeks ago or a month ago, a couple months ago, when we had some of those guests on. This past year in particular, California's had a lot of moving parts with its revenue outlook, the size of its budget deficit, that keeps changing. And it just kind of underscores the like base level of uncertainty that kind of surrounds the state of managing California's budget. And there's some key reasons. I mean, tech and the progressive income tax structure. I'm looking forward to hearing about that, because that is very, very unique to California. I mean, other states are volatile, have volatile revenue streams, oil states, Alaska. I mean, that's they're quirky as well. But I think California's particular situation with how it gets the money it gets, how it gets its tax revenue, how it then can spend that money is also sometimes dicey and has lots of rules and things around that as well. And so just getting her perspective of all of that, of all of the moving parts with California. And then on top of that, just being able to track it and have kind of that unbiased assessment of what direction is the state headed in? I mean, depending on who you ask, the answer could be very, very different. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Yeah, 100%. There are, at last count, almost 100 different mutual funds and exchange-traded funds focused on California municipal bonds. So there's something for everyone, depending on your outlook, depending on your perspective on where you think the state is headed. And layering into that, of course, and what I'm excited to hear from her about is the uncertainty surrounding the election. You mentioned all those sources of of uncertainty. And certainly when we think about California public finance, those who have studying state and local finance, but California public finance in particular for a long time, in fact, one of the famous academic papers looking at California public finance, the title is Vox Populi question mark, i.e. the voice of the people, talking about ballot initiatives and this rich history of fiscal policy making at the ballot box, which takes all of that volatility and uncertainty that you mentioned, and it just amplifies it, right? Just adds this whole other layer of unpredictability. So it's a fascinating place in many ways, a bellwether for what goes on in other places, but also its own animal. Well, we are pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod Jennifer Johnston, who is Senior Vice President and Director of Municipal Bond Research at Franklin Templeton. Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you. And as always, I am, of course, partially biased, not even partially biased towards California topics, but I think especially excited to hear from you since we have so many mutual connections. You live in California, and you bring that municipal analyst perspective to what's going on in the state. So there's been a lot of moving parts lately with the budget. We've previously had, towards the end of last season, we had Gabe Pettick from the fiscal analyst office. We had Fiona Ma on relatively recently, the state treasurer. What's your, assessment? And we now have a signed state budget. The state is trying to address its deficit through a number of ways, including taking money from the rainy day fund. Can you start off by kind of broad brush strokes, giving us your assessment of how the state has approached its budget crisis so far and where we stand too on the revenue situation? Because the size of the deficit has changed. We understand that revenues are super volatile in California, and that expectation keeps changing as well. So what are you seeing now?
Sure. So it's a great question, very comprehensive. And I think when we think about the state of California and their fiscal condition, you can't forget that they do have such a volatile revenue stream. And this is largely due to the fact that income taxes followed by sales taxes are the top two revenue sources, which of course are volatile based on economic conditions, based on demographics, who's paying taxes. So whenever there seems to be a change in the underlying economic current or business, cycle, which is always going to happen, California tends to do better in the good years and worse in the more challenging years. And the worse in the more challenging years is kind of where we are right now. We're seeing a slowdown in economic conditions. Inflation was, such a concern for, at least a year until the Fed started taking action. And inflation actually has a positive impact on tax revenues because it increases the prices of goods. It increases, in many cases, and in the case of California, wages, which drives up personal income taxes, all which has a pronounced effect on the California budget. And, inflation, like it is for people, also raises prices and the cost of borrowing as well. So we have this situation where the state was doing great when revenues were taking off. And as they start to slow, thanks in part to Fed actions on interest rates, you're having revenue growth slow. And in California, it's a little bit more aggressive than it is elsewhere. And that is largely due to sort of the tax system on the personal income tax side. In California, income tax rate increases depending on your income level. And as a result, there's actually just a handful of Californians that pay most of the taxes that the state collects every year. And it's very different what the income mix is for the very wealthy in California, as opposed to just, kind of a regular average employee. A wealthy individual probably has a basket of, traditional income, maybe bonus income, depending on the industry that they're in. They could have IPO activity, which has often driven a lot of the revenue performance in California. And they probably have a lot of investments in the market, and capital gains can play a huge role in what revenues the state collects. So depending on what the market does, if, the wealthy have a lot of investments, then you're likely to see revenues perform either positive or negative, depending on the markets. And we've had a roller coaster over the last few years in that realm. So as a result, there are very few people that pay a lot of the taxes in the state of California. And so to the extent that their wealth changes or they leave the state of California, something like that, it can actually have a fairly sizable impact on the state. And so that's what the state's been confronted with. Having said that, coming into this sort of slowing economic period, the state's fiscal position was extremely strong. Like states across the country, we had a really strong post-pandemic economy. Again, inflation drove up revenues, and the state socked away a lot of money in reserve. And that is a critical credit feature in our mind for the state of California because of that volatility. Mm-hmm. The state needs to have a reserve to go to, as well as just other budget tools to access in these periods where everything is so off kilter, because the state is still charged with providing services to its residents, a significant one, which is education. And you don't want them just cutting expenses in a given year because revenues are down. You want them to be able to consistently fund so that school districts can educate children, as an example. So having reserves is necessary to give the state the flexibility and the ability to manage its budgets in all economic cycles.
I mean, California has so many. One quick follow-up or comment, maybe, is that every state is unique, right? But California seems to have a lot of unique features, and the revenue volatility is a big one, but then even how it funds its education. I mean, it must be a steep learning curve if you're an analyst going from analyzing one state and then transitioning to California. Does it make it difficult to compare California to other states in that way?
It does. And, you know, I think it's one of the challenges of being an analyst that people like me love is the fact that there is all this nuance and difference. And, you know, one of the things that I think is also unique about California is how much decision making is done on the ballot in the election every year. And you mentioned school funding, and that's a perfect example in that a large way about how school funding is determined every year was determined by a proposition that was on the ballot. And now that closely links school funding to the amount of tax revenue that the state brings in. So in some ways, these things actually handcuff the legislature. When it comes time to make decisions, you know, they have propositions that have been passed in previous years that often guide a lot of that. Mm. So the amount of the budget that a legislator can actually control is low here in California. It's another kind of unique thing. And I'm sure we'll talk about sort of, you know, how we watch elections and what might have been on the ballot in November in California. But we have to pay a lot of attention to that to really understand those nuances. And, you know, one of the things that we're always telling people, you know, when you're trying to invest in this space, there's a lot to consider. If you're going to buy a 30-year bond, you know, from a municipality, how much do you really understand about it? And, you know, our approach is, that's why municipal bond mutual funds are such a great investment opportunity, because not only do you get your tax exemption, but you have people like me who get paid to spend their entire day understanding these different nuances and recognizing, you know, when these challenges hit a state like California or any other state, you know, what are the tools that this state has in its tool belt, which might be different than other states throughout the country.
Yeah.
Liz mentioned that there is a budget now. And I was wondering, for anyone who might not have been following California's budget gyrations over the last weeks and months here, if you could maybe give us just a quick high-level summary of what was done to address that budget deficit. And then what's your take on that? What's your assessment of how the governor and the legislature ultimately address this in the current budget cycle?
Sure. So the budget season, as we like to think about it, kicks off in January in California, where the governor gives his first kind of outline of what he sees as performance for the current fiscal year and what he anticipates in the next fiscal year. And when he released this budget back in January, it was an extremely large number. And it was a complicated number because it actually was more than just one fiscal year. And there's a lot of nuance around that number as well. But he also outlines a number of solutions that the legislature could adopt to address that deficit. And when we look at those solutions, our viewpoint is that we want to see a state take a very thoughtful approach to doing it. Governance and how fiscal management is done at a state is an important credit factor for us. You know, we want them to not rely on one-time revenues that don't appear the next year, because we don't want a one-time revenue source to fund something that's going to, again, show a budget gap another year later. So we want to see recurring revenues, recurring expenditures, as opposed to one-time revenues and one-time expenditures, unless they offset themselves. Reserves are an incredibly important tool that's available, but we don't want to see a state like California or any other state use all of the reserves in 1 year. We're at the beginning of what's likely to be an economic cycle of some point. We want there to be revenue or reserves available in future years, should this revenue situation continue or there are important needs that the state needs to fund. So we were really looking for kind of a bunch of different solutions, and that's what the governor gave us. Then in May, he comes out with an updated version of his budget. And it wasn't a surprise to us because we can follow the state's financials on a monthly basis, but the state actually underperformed the revenue assumptions that he had outlined in January. So we'd been underperforming, they did a new forecast, and then we underperformed that. So we knew we were going into May in a situation where revenues were actually going to be lower than they thought in just January. So that was a bit of a concern. But one thing the state did do is they adopted some early solutions to address the mid-year budget gap, as well as the budget gap for the future year. So it was about $17 billion in action items that were passed in March, I believe, which helps erase some of that deficit. So when we saw the updated proposal in May, you know, we saw the unexpected or the expected revenue underperformance, and of course the benefit from these early actions. But we saw a slightly different take on how the state should resolve that, how they should close that budget gap. And there was actually some interesting things in it. First, the governor wanted to view the budget cycle as a 2-year cycle, which many states do. They actually budget on a biennium basis, and he wanted to put that out there so that, you know, legislators and decision makers and analysts really understood how decisions today are going to impact the state the next time budget cycle comes around. So we actually view that as a positive development in terms of financial management. Number two, he wanted to, recognizing the volatility that the state has with revenues, he wanted to introduce a new type of reserve fund. We haven't seen a lot of details on that yet. It's something that's been tabled to come up again in a few months. But again, trying to address this volatility, being able to capture some more revenue and spend it in a more appropriate way. So we view that as a positive. And then the other thing that was the biggest surprise is he actually wanted to use fewer reserve dollars to close the budget gap and rely more on cuts. And that surprised us a little bit. It was a bit of a turn from what he had proposed back in January. And, you know, you can debate whether or not those cuts make the most sense for the state. But the benefit that we saw is he's leaving a decent amount of money in reserves so that the state can leverage that. And there's a couple of, you know, things that we're going to be looking at. Number one, okay, so we know we didn't quite meet the revenue estimates in January. Well, what's it going to look like over the next few months? Are we going to see revenues continue to underperform? Are we going to meet expectations? What's that going to look like? So we've got reserves still out there that the state can tap if it turns out the budget estimates weren't conservative enough. And then in general, if we see spending take off, if there's additional priorities that the governor has that he wants to fund, there's ample reserves available. So we believe that it should preserve the rating, the fact that they've left so much in reserve, but really the key is going to be, is all of this achievable? Are the revenues going to come in where they expect, and can they keep spending where they've budgeted?
Thinking about this, the boom and bust cycle that California is on, potentially having yet another lever to pull in terms of flexible reserve funds, what is a good mindset to have in terms of how to approach those funds? You mentioned, obviously, the state doesn't want to drain all of its reserves in 1 year, not really what they're for. But as with a state that has such volatile revenue in and out, I mean, are there other reasons besides revenue volatility that California should maintain a certain level of money in its reserve funds, or have more than one reserve fund?
Sure. And, you know, I think we believe, you know, across the U.S., there are many states that don't have the same volatility, and we would expect them to have reserves as well. We just expect California to have additional reserves to account for the volatility. And, you know, I think what it comes down to is the same reason that you kind of want to have a personal savings account for unexpected challenges. You know, in states, what's unique and maybe different from the federal government is in all but one, you have to have a balanced budget. We can't print money in the state of California. So you have to be able to close that budget gap. And, you know, you don't want to be in a situation where you would have to cut school spending by 20% in any given year. There's just not enough time for schools to be able to address that. And you would never want to impact, you know, learning and the next generation of students. So they want to be able to maintain services from year to year. So even if it's not the volatility you see in California, we still think that reserves are a crucial component of anybody's, you know, fiscal challenges. And if you look at some of the states nationwide that have had, you know, severe budget challenges that are more from a management and governance perspective than, you know, maybe this volatility that is part of the state's rating, something we all understand, you know, some of those states that were so poorly rated was because they just did not have reserves. They couldn't build them. They're mm-hmm. just trying to keep up with, you know, the ongoing funding needs of their state and right-sizing some liabilities. You know, and it wasn't until after the pandemic that they could actually create reserves and start building towards that. And all of a sudden now they're rated higher than they were coming into the pandemic. So it's an interesting credit metric we've seen leveraged throughout the country. But we think it's just like you would have a personal, you know, savings account for, you know, if your water heater breaks, you know, you want states to be able to maintain the quality of life, you know, regardless of whether or not you succumb to the boom and bust that is the volatility here in California. And I do think it's important to recognize that, you know, this is all factored in the state's rating. You know, this is something that's such a strong part of California's fiscal condition that we all understand it. It doesn't surprise us. You know, we read the headlines in the newspapers and, you know, oftentimes, you know, I look at that headline and it doesn't surprise me. You know, this is what, you know, we know to be the case in California. And, you know, we require extra steps to maintain the high quality ratings that the state enjoys. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that they were to let reserves dwindle or use them, which they have in prior years, you know, it would certainly impact the rating.
Yeah.
Jennifer, every time we've talked about California budgeting and finance, somebody says something about housing affordability. It seems to be such a key question, and really real estate broadly, which makes a lot of sense given everything you were just saying about connections to property taxes and the unique structure California has for particularly for school finance. At the same time, I know you've looked specifically at commercial real estate as a particular credit concern. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that and its connection to credit quality for states and localities.
Yeah. So this has been something that's, you know, been on our mind as we try to think about what the world looks like in the post-COVID economy. And one of the things that has impacted people across the country is how we work and where we work. For some people, it's a hybrid situation where you're only in the office 2 or 3 days a week. In some cases, they can work from home the whole time, which means they can basically live anywhere and perhaps in a state or area not where their employer was historically based. So this has really created a situation where companies and employers don't need the office space that they once needed. And so as a result, we're seeing a lot of offices downsize or completely get rid of office space because they just don't need it, quite frankly. And, you know, the impact that that has on a city or a county or on a school district is then what comes, you know, top of mind for us. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is property taxes. So whoever owns that office building in downtown San Francisco pays property taxes that the city and county of San Francisco then use to fund schools and, you know, the city's projects, the county's projects, all those types of things. So to the extent that a large, valuable piece of real estate is either sold at a big discount, which would reset the value on which the property taxes are levied, that could have a financial impact on the city and county. So the first thing we did is look at some of these big urban centers, San Francisco as an example, to understand, well, how much does the office and commercial component of the city impact revenues? And for most cities, San Francisco included, the property tax revenue is largely generated from residential real estate, which is extremely diverse, you know, because, you know, people don't own $50 million office towers, you know, they own still expensive, you know, $1 million homes. But the impact, therefore, is going to be more driven what happens on the residential side than that does the commercial side. So, you know, kind of our first check mark is, okay, understanding how this is going to have an impact on property taxes. And in our case, And in many cases, it's probably not meaningful, but it's everything else that does matter. If you live outside of San Francisco and came into San Francisco every day for work, you are having your lunch, you are getting your clothes dry cleaned. Maybe you were picking up a gift before you got on BART to get home. There was economic generation in these neighborhoods, and that's no longer happening. So to the extent that that impacts sales taxes, it impacts mass transit, which is a whole other conversation, the BART system, which is our rapid transit here in San Francisco, or even like the MTA in New York City are seeing huge changes in ridership because people just don't need to get into those urban centers anymore. So you know, it's really kind of those types of implications that we're spending more time. One of, we have seen some trends in San Francisco where, you know, sales taxes are moving around. So sales tax generation in our financial district is down, as one would expect, given the occupancy issues. But we are seeing some neighborhoods trip up because now instead of buying my lunch and doing my dry cleaning in the financial district, I'm doing it in my neighborhood. So we have seen just some transfers, but the fact that fewer people are coming into these urban cores are going to change the overall revenue stream. So that's what we're focused on. And then to the extent that the individual no longer needs to work where their employer is and they can just leave, taxes are expensive, house prices are expensive. Are people just going to get up and leave San Francisco or California? Mm-hmm. And so that is a slower trend and one we keep watching. But again, that can impact these communities, their tax rates and the services that they provide if, you know, people who have the means to move to Texas are up and moving to Texas. Now, the data that we've seen so far, there are definitely people who have left, but there's still people coming into the state, which is important. People still want to come to California. We're still a huge tech hub. And so there still are people that want to come here. Yes, people are leaving. And, you know, the important thing is, and I mentioned it earlier about the wealth, are the wealthy leaving? Because there aren't a lot of people that are paying, you know, it's a small group of people that pay the most taxes. You want them to stay in California and not leave for Texas or Florida. So we continue to watch that. So this to us is still evolving. You know, I don't think the return to office is set yet. There, I know, you know, just amongst, you know, anecdotally amongst my friends, my own company, it's always changing. So, you know, the question is for these, you know, mayors and, you know, supervisors and, you know, all that kind of stuff is how do you keep people in your city? How do you entice people to want to come in and buy real estate to, you know, set up their businesses here? And in San Francisco, you know, a lot of people see the center of AI as being kind of economic driver of what's going to bring people back into San Francisco. And that's going to be critical because we need people in those office space. You know, we need people to come into the city. And, you know, unless we can find a affordable way to convert this office space to residential, you know, that's going to be your fastest way is to entice employers to come back to San Francisco. So we will watch, but, you know, thankfully we think that the direct impact on city and county revenues, it's something, but it's not going to send San Francisco into a downward spiral.
You know, about a year ago, we heard pretty much nonstop bad news coming out of the tech sector, lots of layoffs. That tide seems to have turned within the last few months, particularly with AI, as you mentioned, in the Bay Area, clearly positioning itself as the hub of AI. From a credit analyst perspective, when you think about the tech sector generally, net positive, net negative, does it contribute to that cyclicality that we were talking about, or does it kind of blunt it? Lots of places I'm sure would give anything to have a Silicon Valley in their state, but it certainly comes with some trade-offs as a from a credit perspective.
Sure. So it's a great question. And I think, you know, in many ways, having something that drives a local economy is a good thing. You know, you have communities that might have a huge amusement park or they're located along the water. Like there's something that drives people to want to come to that place. And for many years, decades, tech has been that for California. People want to come where the money is, where the VC firms are, you know, where there's rich talent coming out of, you know, the universities. There's a lot of creative thinking. It is an environment that helps make all of that come to be. And so that has been a huge positive for the state of California. Now, there have been multiple times over the past 20 years where that's had a very negative impact. And that cyclicality certainly adds to the ongoing cyclicality, because we're talking about employment, which leads to personal income taxes, again, the state's largest revenue source, the wealth that's generated by these people through IPOs, that helps the coffers as well as this at the state level. It allows them to, allows individuals who've come into wealth through the IPOs to buy very expensive homes, especially as prices continue to rise, particularly here in the Bay Area. And, you know, that can have a positive impact. So there's definitely positives and negatives. And it just kind of goes along with the cyclicality of what California is kind of known for. So to the point you were saying, yes, there were definitely layoffs. And, you know, we saw employment numbers in the state of California underperform the rest of the nation over the past year. So we definitely could see that in our employment numbers. And it's part of the reason why, you know, income taxes have underperformed, is because there have been layoffs. There's not as much IPO activity. So there's not as much revenue being generated from that as well. So it's not just layoffs and personal income. It's IPOs. It's, you know, people taking this wealth to buy homes. So it's definitely a credit metric that you see throughout multiple aspects of state and local credit. And you want to have something. It is good to have tech. You know, we managed to get through this period with the most recent tech layoffs. Can AI solve for that? You know, we don't know yet. It's certainly definitely a lot of hype right now. You know, you hear about companies moving to San Francisco. Their employees want to be here. Young people want to be here who spend a lot of money, which generates sales taxes. So there's a good feeling right now. But, you know, it's sort of this, is it this transition between kind of older technology and the new technology, which is AI. And that's going to be just sort of a generational shift there that we're going to have to see, you know, what that means longer term.
Yeah, it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not putting much stock in this idea that folks like Elon Musk like to talk about, how in, within a generation, all the techies are going to be moving, living in Texas because it's cheaper to live there and there's no income tax and all of the other, all of those other things. Probably also hotter, but just saying. Is there, you mentioned young people, that there's a feeling or vibe. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Is there an in-migration story that's kind of percolating under the surface here?
Yeah, and I think that's important. And I think when we think about immigration, there's actually two factors. I think there's the young folks who will come in. They, you know, they may not earn a ton because they're just starting in their jobs, but they spend a lot of money. They're, you know, they're either going on trips or they're, you know, at the bar every night. They're eating out in restaurants. They generate sales taxes and they generate jobs and they, you know, generate this economic engine that propels so many different economies that it really is important. Now, the thing that we always talk about is that when you think about demographic shifts like this, it's different to think about it through the lens of the state than it is through the locals. Because if you follow a 20-something moving to San Francisco for their cool job in AI, you know, they're going to live in San Francisco. They're going to, you know, really propel the economy. They're going to rent starting off and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Then, you know, they'll get into their 30s, you know, maybe they get married, they have a kid, they probably leave San Francisco and they're going to maybe move to a suburb, which bears no influence on the state. You know, the state's still going to collect the revenue, but you're seeing a shift of these folks out of San Francisco into the surrounding communities. So that's where the surrounding communities get to capture their home purchase, their property taxes, whereas they've now left the city and moved outside. So it's extremely important. And this is actually something that, you know, we think about a lot when we think about Chicago and, you know, folks moving there and whether or not they stay in the city or leave the city. San Francisco is similar in that most people will end up leaving the city once they marry and have children because it's just so darn expensive. And, you know, so that's the good thing. We want these young people to come so they help support the cities and then they get ingrained in an area and then just move to the suburbs. But the other aspect of it is, you know, is international in migration. So people who move here from other countries, and that has ebbed and flowed depending on some federal policies and things like that. But that's another thing that we're watching to see the extent to how that continues on. So we'll watch that, see how, you know, and that's an area where federal policy can have an impact on how that affects states and their local governments. So, you know, we're optimistic that, you know, when young people come in, you know, it's going to be good for the economy in that way. Specifically to your comment about Elon Musk, sure, that's happened. There are people who have left the state, moved their businesses elsewhere. And it's definitely pressure on the state of California to figure out how do they create a business environment that's conducive for starting a business here. And part of that is going to be a package that they can offer to their employees and, you know, expensive housing or expensive, you know, even if it's just rent, that can have an impact. So it's something we watch. You know, we know that it's happening. It's not happening to the detriment yet. That's going to take decades to happen. And, you know, if I were a state legislator or decision maker, I would want to prepare for that. And, you know, it takes a lot for a state, you know, state level, you know, legislator to worry about the future as opposed to, you know, the challenges that they're dealing with right now. But, you know, ideally you'll have a situation where the state recognizes that this is an issue and tries to adjust to manage that. And, it, you know, in some case, if, you know, we lost a segment of the economy, hopefully there's something else up and coming to replace that. And AI is an example of how we're seeing that kind of on a small sector basis.
Interesting.
California, more so than a lot of other states, has this really tight nexus. You alluded to it earlier between elections and public finance, particularly state and local public finance. We're going into a very consequential national election here in a few months. And with that, of course, a lot of consequential state and local elections. When you think broadly about the upcoming election, what it means for credit quality in California, what are some of the highlights for you?
Sure. So we definitely separated between, you know, kind of what the federal impact could be and then what the state and local impact could be. And when I talk to analysts in sectors, not in the muni sector, they're always so shocked at why we care so much about state and local. But that I would actually argue that's probably the more important from a credit perspective. You know, we watch what happens at the national level, more for things like tax policy, which can have an implication on municipal bonds and, you know, how attractive they are as sort of a way to address taxes and stuff like that. But, you know, our concern more at the federal level is on anything that would create a policy that could impact the state. And it's just not as direct as it is for state and local elections on state and local governments. And here, there's kind of like three categories that we would look at. Number one, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about budgets, and this is a 6-month process for most states and local governments in one way or another. And, you know, the ability to determine consensus, come to an agreement is important. And that is easier in a situation where a governor and a legislature are of the same party, more like-minded. It's easier to come to consensus than a divided government. And, you know, we haven't had that situation in California in a while. And last time it was actually fairly smooth, all things considered. But we highlight a lot of times Illinois in this scenario where they had a governor and legislature that were of two different parties. And it was a significant and severe budget crisis that that state went through because they couldn't get a budget passed. And they were basically losing opportunities to address revenue changes, and it really hurt the state. And at the state level, that's one of the things we look for. Are we going to see a party, the same party controlling everything? Because it should ease the budget process, help us get to decisions. So that's something we look at the state level. We don't mind as much at the local level because a lot of people run not attached to a party at the local level. So that aspect's a little bit different between the state and locals. The second thing we'll look at is any kind of proposition or ballot measure that could impact taxes or financial management. And I alluded to this around school funding earlier. California is a place where we love to put things on the ballot and vote on it. And in some cases, that can be positive and negative. You know, in a situation where you're trying to create a reserve fund, you know, that's probably something that's going to be positive for the state. It helps address the volatility. But at the same time, do you have a ballot measure that's going to, you know, roll back taxes, or is it going to put handcuffs on your legislators so that they can't actually make decisions? And, you know, are we going to have situations like that? And there was actually a ballot measure that had been proposed for November that just got thrown out by the state Supreme Court that, you know, in our mind could have been a challenge from a financial management for the state and local governments who would actually have to go, we'd have to go back in time and actually approve, reapprove certain tax measures that had been passed several years ago would have been very disruptive to the ability for local governments and the state, for that matter, to govern themselves. And so, you know, we're looking for things like that. In California, I've mentioned many times how our tax system is progressive in that you pay a higher tax rate the more money you make. And a lot of that is driven by ballot measure items that, you know, they would put on a little like kind of additional percentage that people over $1 million had to pay for mental health services, things like that. So following what goes on at the ballot can really have an impact on what the state's credit looks like, whether it's purely just adding revenue to the coffers or perhaps increasing the volatility, which is what happens when you tax just millionaires, those types of things. So we pay a lot of attention to that. And then the final thing we watch, if that wasn't enough to keep us busy in November, is bond measures. A significant number of bond measures, particularly those that are general obligation in nature, have to go in front of voters. And of course, you know, many municipal governments have huge, massive capital plans that they need to fulfill every year. And they put those measures in front of voters before, you know, leveraging the voters' taxing power on debt. And so we watch that to get a sense of, you know, what are the kind of capital priorities? How do voters view that? You know, we had a ballot measure in March here in California that had a very narrow approval rate. Like they didn't even know how it had finished on election day. And that's an interesting, I think, message from the voters that I presume the state will be considering as it considers additional large ballot measures. But from a, you know, more market technical supply demand situation, you know, we follow kind of what ballot measures, you know, we're putting on the ballot. So we can get a sense for what the state's capital plans are going to be over the next, you know, 3, 5, 7 years as those bond measures are issued and then spent.
Good question to tie all this together for you, Jennifer. So given everything we've talked about here today, all these really, really interesting trends, you'd mentioned a little bit ago, the value add of an active investment strategy, an active portfolio management strategy for munis. If you are one of those school districts, you're the CFO of one of those school districts, you're the city manager of a municipality in California, what is it that they can be doing now to get the attention of people like yourself to try to best position themselves to be in the kinds of portfolios that folks like yourself are building?
Sure. So the number one thing is going to be transparency and communication to ensure that we understand fully their financial situation. You know, the state of California is extremely transparent. It has monthly revenue disclosure, so we can track what's going on, but that's not the same at the local levels. And so it's really important that these local governments have transparency, communicate well with bondholders, as well, honestly, as taxpayers and the parents. Like, we're all on the same page here wanting to understand, you know, how a school district provides its services to its students and how it funds it. So a lot of it is communication. Obviously, please pay your debt. But, you know, outside of that, it's really, you know, communication, making sure you're being transparent. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all trying to have a successful school district, as an example. If the school district is successful, it works for the families that live in the area, it works for bondholders, and it works for them. So,
well, thanks so much to Jennifer Johnson, Senior Vice President and Director of Municipal Bond Research at Franklin Templeton. We really appreciate you sharing your insights with us today.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks again to Jennifer Johnson. That was a really great way to kind of cover a lot of bases in California, quite a lot of topics. I feel better maybe about the outlook for my home state. And we talked a bit about that budget deal. So I pulled the latest story on it. The budget deal was reached just this past weekend. So wanted to kind of run through some of the biggies there to provide a little bit of additional context to that conversation that we just had. The story I got is from the LA Times, and it is written by Taryn Luna. Headline says, Newsom lawmakers use cuts, reserves, and fiscal emergency declaration to solve the budget deficit. The state has a, as of now, $46.8 billion budget deficit. That's the number they're going by. And so the Governor Newsom and Democratic lawmakers struck a deal Saturday to make $16 billion in cuts. That includes declaring a statewide fiscal emergency, but that's what's part of what's required to then be able to pull money from the rainy day fund. So that is kind of the basis for that, although the article does mention it's going to give fodder for lawmakers to use against the governor. A couple of highlights here, or more than a couple of highlights. This article is very detailed. So this is among the more high-profile changes. The budget plan delays a planned minimum wage increase for healthcare workers until at least October of this year. It cuts a little over $1 billion for affordable housing that they were planning on spending, and takes away and slashes $750 million in funding for the state prison system. So those are all those cuts that Jennifer mentioned. Other delays in funding. So it says everybody took a hit here, the business community included. So there's a 3-year suspension. So there were going to be roughly $15 billion in tax breaks for the business community. The state has now suspended those tax breaks for 3 years, but it's done it a year earlier than it said it was going to. So basically moved up a planned suspension of those tax breaks. There's and the article notes, again, that revenue volatility, it does a good job kind of explaining it. It talks about this dramatic reversal of California's fiscal standing from just 2 years ago when it had a projected $100 billion surplus. Notes that this whole thing creates a challenging narrative for Newsom. Again, pointing out that they had to declare a fiscal emergency. It's got critics. David Crane from the nonprofit Govern for California says that this is not a revenue problem, though, from his perspective. The deficit is a result of expenditures. And the article notes that he's certainly not wrong, that the financial problem can be blamed, in part at least, on poor revenue projections that then led Newsom and lawmakers to allocate more money for programs than they actually had available to spend. Gabe Pettit talked a little bit about that when he was on a while ago. Again, the state's progressive income tax structure is subject to stock market fluctuations, difficult to predict. A couple of more details from the article. It says Newsom anticipated California's deficit to grow when he signed the budget last year, and said that much of the new money that was in that spending plan was due to one-time funding increases that could easily be halted. And so that's, again, just kind of underscoring the fact that California, to me, it reminds me of when Jennifer was talking about how this is mindset is kind of built into the budget at this point. And that to me is an example of that. The amount that the state is pulling from the rainy day fund, that's still, even though the state, it doesn't say what the total size of it is, but as I recall, it's very, very large. It's a technical term there. The article notes the state pulled $5.1 billion for the 24/25 fiscal year, plans to pull a little over $7 billion the following year to avoid deeper cuts. And the article then goes on into more detail about some of these specific pullbacks on spending or spending cuts, depending on how you want to characterize it. A lot of detail. I highly recommend reading it if you really kind of want to understand the nuts and bolts of this budget deal. I'm struck again by how, for the second year in a row, I'm talking about another California budget deal with lawmakers closing a deficit. And so, again, makes me wonder what we'll be talking about, if this will be over for California or not. It's certainly been a rough couple of years for the state. But Justin, what are, I guess, in the context of what we just talked about with Jennifer and the detail that this article goes into, curious what some of your kind of broader takeaways are as well.
Yeah. So if you start with just the big numbers, I mean, $300 billion budget and a $300 billion budget, and then this massive budget deficit against the backdrop of a $100 billion surplus just a few years ago. Just, you have to just stop and pause and yeah. Let your brain sort that out a second. Those are just numbers that outside of California are really hard to get your brain around, because that's such a scale difference between there and so many other places. And I thought you did a great job of summarizing some of the main takeaways and how it goes into some more detail above and beyond the kinds of things that Jennifer talked about. One of the things that really jumped out to me in this article that was an interesting discussion that might very well be a harbinger of things to come was the focus on the state's Medicaid program and the effect of healthcare more generally on the state budget, which is something that I don't think we talk often enough, and we try on this podcast to get folks to talk about state Medicaid programs as a really core part of what goes on in state finances. But this piece goes into some detail and might very well signal some things that other states are going to have to go through in the not too distant future. Coming out of COVID, there was this, I think, shared understanding that Medicaid programs were, it was not a good time to think about doing any sort of cuts to Medicaid programs, eroding that safety net at a time that so many people needed it, putting healthcare providers who are reimbursed through Medicaid at risk of lower payments or not having resources they needed to be able to deliver those really critical services. That was just a non-starter, non sequitur in the immediate aftermath of COVID. A lot of what's happening in this budget sort of suggests we may have moved past that now. And you see things like delaying a wage increase for healthcare employees, particularly those in Medicaid financed healthcare systems, as a part of the, you know, the budget balancing strategies that the governor put in place. The article talks about this battle that is going on around a managed care organization tax, right? A tax on MCOs that was really designed to provide more resources for the state's Medicaid program, something that a lot of other states have talked about. That's a way to essentially redistribute resources from the private healthcare system to the public healthcare system. When you stop to think about it, it's really what an MCO tax is doing. And as part of this, the governor has said, a ballot initiative that's forthcoming that would put in place that tax and make more resources available to the state Medicaid system. The governor essentially said, can we hit pause on that? And if this happens, there's a good chance that parts of it won't be implemented anytime soon, just because the state can't afford to have the kind of new demands for funding that will come into the state Medicaid program as a result of this ballot initiative being passed. Again, all of which, if you're a critic, you say, I can't believe that we're turning our backs on healthcare providers, even as we have not fully moved on from COVID and its effects. But the fiscal reality seems to be that that's where some of this is going. So it's going to be really interesting to see if other states adopt a similar sort of strategy. There's just so much money in Medicaid programs. It's just, you can't make state budget policy without actively managing some of those Medicaid financing questions. And so it's happening in California. Interesting to see if it happens elsewhere.
Good points.
Thanks again to our Season 3 sponsors, Build America Mutual, DebtBook, the Government Finance Officers Association, MuniPro, and Odyssey Advisors. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Alex Kroger. You can learn more about the Center and its work, including recent and past episodes of the Public Money Pod, at the Center's website, munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.